Hello, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with the Arizona Daily Sun for Friday, April 25th. I'm Flagstaff volunteer reader Julia. Front page articles include Northern Arizona University leaders present update on current priorities and challenges, Pine Forest School celebrates 30 years in Flagstaff, and NAZ Elite this week, Kiptu hits PR at Boston Marathon while continuing to learn the ropes. The article we will be starting with today is Northern Arizona University leaders present update on current priorities and challenges. Leaders from Northern Arizona University presented an update on the institution's current state and how it has been responding to challenges in higher education at a recent Arizona Board of Regents meeting. NAU President Jose Luis Cruz Rivera and four other administrators presented the university's operational and financial review for fiscal year 2025. Cruz Rivera spent 45 minutes during the meeting outlining the university's current successes, challenges, and plans to respond to changing demands in higher education. Over the next 2 hours, four members of the president's cabinet went into more detail on enrollment, employees, research, and university finances. Annika Olson, Vice President of Enrollment Manager, Karen Puglisi, Executive Vice President and Provost, Jason Wilder, Vice President for Research, and Bjorn Flugstad, Vice President for University Operations and Chief Financial Officer, presented the specifics related to their roles. Cruz Rivera said NAU is in a strong position, both operationally and financially, but added that there are also real risks it needs to address to remain that way. While several of the areas of strength and concern were related to each other, overall, Cruz Rivera expressed optimism about NAU's ability to address its current needs. The question isn't whether NAU is strong today. The evidence, I think, clearly demonstrates we are, he said. The question is whether we can sustain this strength against these powerful headwinds. I know we will survive. I know we will be better than ever. I know we will be very different than we are. Expanding access. Cruz Rivera said NAU's focus and a strength is making college accessible, particularly to students with additional barriers to higher education. In the fall semester of 2023, the university saw a 3% increase in Arizona resident students and a 47% increase in Native American students, with about a third of undergraduates being Pell Grant recipients and around half of undergraduates a part of either Access to Excellence or the Arizona Promise program. Other ongoing access programs at NAU include its admissions requirement pilot program, statewide and online options, A++, and the upcoming H5 coalition with high schools throughout Arizona. He also said the university's Arizona resident serving mission may pose a strategic risk, given state funding reductions and competition from other institutions. As we get more funding from the state or figure out new ways of generating revenue to offset those investments, our enrollment mix needs to change, he said. Yet our ability to change that enrollment mix is also complicated by some of the federal policies that are being put in place and how they play into international student visas, for example. Increasing skepticism about the value of higher education is also a challenge. Though Cruz Rivera said conversations with NAU graduates have shown the impact of completing a college degree, he also said the university needs to recognize and acknowledge the failures, such as limited access to higher education and those who did not complete a degree but still have debt and barriers to returning to college. That is what is driving that skepticism. We can talk forever about the value of higher education, but that value is only there when someone is given the opportunity to go to college and is given the support they need to graduate with a degree that has market value, he said. The university's priorities through 2030, as outlined in its Elevating Excellence Roadmap, finalized in 2022, focused on increasing college completion as well as enrollment. By 2030, according to Cruz Rivera, NAU will have enrolled 2,500 first-generation and lower-income students, 85% of whom will be continuing or graduating. NAU is on track to award 100,000 credentials by 2035, he added. Our approach is about creating the right balance between access and success, he said, not cherry-picking students through exclusive admissions who artificially inflate graduation rates, but doing the hard work of supporting students from all walks of life through to completion. Prioritizing programs. The university is focusing on academic programs related to Arizona's workforce needs, he said, such as education and social science at the undergraduate level, and computer and information sciences, education and health at the graduate level. Cruz Rivera mentioned the NAU Health Initiative as an area of strength. NAU is still planning to double its total of health program graduates by 2030, and as of this February, was on track to reach that goal. NAU is a leading source of qualified nursing and behavioral health professionals that are prepared to serve in Arizona communities. But the reality is that leveraging our statewide infrastructure and partnerships in rural communities requires additional investments from the state, he said. We are very hopeful for that as we move forward in our conversations and our advocacy efforts. Talent management, such as employee retention, is a risk to NAU, in part because of Flagstaff's high cost of living. Cruz Rivera said the city's cost of living is currently 122.1% of the national average. That poses a challenge for both recruiting students and retaining employees. This is the one I am worried most about, he said. We have our work cut out for us in that area. Research and funding. NAU is similarly prioritizing research in areas of regional needs and knowledge, such as wildfire management, water, and climate. After changes to the designation requirements, the university also recently earned R1 status for the first time. Sustainability of funding for that research at both state and federal level is another risk Cruz Rivera mentioned, however. Focusing on specific clusters of excellence has been one of the ways of responding to this, he said, along with synergies between research and instruction and developing partnerships with the other state universities, industry, and government. He said NAU has operational resilience in all of the above areas, both maintaining financial stability and moving toward university goals. Operational costs were among the risks he listed. However, as they continue to grow, alongside changes to regulatory compliance and federal policy changes. Infrastructure challenges, such as deferred maintenance, are another area affected by increasing costs and decreasing state investments. Funding streams, financial aid programs, and research grants are essential to our success, he said. Our resilience isn't theoretical. Cruz Rivera concluded his portion of the presentation by outlining ways the board could assist NAU in these efforts, including public advocacy, policy support for a differentiated model based on the specifics of NAU's mission, and TRIF investments. He said he believed NAU would be able to pivot in response to its current challenges, giving examples of ways NAU has adapted in the past. These ranged from accepting livestock for tuition payments during the Great Depression to the financial aid team's work responding to last year's FAFSA complications. "Our resilience isn't theoretical," he said. "I've witnessed it in action." He added in a different part of the presentation, "I think higher education and NAU, we have been working in a backdrop of increasing difficulty, complexity, and turbulence. COVID laid bare the fissures in our systems, and we know that no policies or politics can change the realities of, for example, the demographic shift that is now upon us. How we at NAU and other institutions across the country meet this moment and adapt our approaches and articulate and deliver on the value that we promise the students and society is the measure by which we will be judged." A recording of the full presentation is available at youtube.com/@ABOR News, with the operational and financial review beginning about an hour and 5 minutes into the April 10th board meeting. Presentations from the vice presidents begin at about an hour and 50 minutes. And that was the article, "Northern Arizona University Leaders Present Update on Current Priorities and Challenges." The next article for today is "Pine Forest School Celebrates 30 Years in Flagstaff." Pine Forest Charter School recently celebrated its 30th anniversary as it continues its plans of educating and adapting to the needs of the children it teaches. The Flagstaff Charter School uses the Waldorf method to teach students from preschool through 8th grade. Waldorf education, which was established in 1919, is meant to encourage the development of the whole child through a mix of academics and practical and artistic activities, according to Pine Forest's website. Arizona has 7 Waldorf schools, according to Cindy Rowe, Pine Forest's Director of Operations. Pine Forest first started in 1995. Some of the school's founders were at the anniversary celebration on April 4th through 6th, along with about 100 alums. The weekend featured a variety of activities, including a dance party, classroom showcase, and several Remember When arts and crafts activities. Rowe has led the school since the 2018 to 2019 school year and spent the majority of her career working in Waldorf schools. "I feel the children really know who they are," she said of the impact of this style of education. "They have had the opportunity to explore their world. We're not just shoving stuff in their brain. They are exploring a child's world, all the way up to 14. And we consciously bring to them, at their developmental stage, what is right for them. Children leave us knowing who they are and what they want to do in the world." Continuing to educate. Over the next 30 years, Rowe said, the school plans to continue its work educating Flagstaff students and respond to their changing needs. "We are in the curriculum. We are meeting the children and continuing to approach the kids as they're coming to us," she said. Right now, she said that looks like adapting to the widespread availability of the internet and social media to give them capacities to problem solve strategically and be involved in the world in an engaged way. "Children are exposed to a wide range of information from a young age," Rowe said, adding that Pine Forest has been responding to this by meeting students where they're at developmentally. "Just acknowledging that we all have a development that we're not going through to not turn that off for children, to really acknowledge and be aware that children are children," she said. "I see children come here and they soften, and they wake up and they're self-aware and aware of the other." The school has kids create their own handwritten and illustrated version of textbooks, for example, as a way to ensure they are learning through understanding rather than memorization. Each classroom has a chalkboard for illustrations from the students, as well as the instructional materials. Earlier this week, the sixth grade class was getting ready for the Arizona Medieval Games, an event for the state's Waldorf schools meant to teach students about medieval and Renaissance history through hands-on activities. Rowe said Pine Forest also has a goal of becoming a flagship school for Waldorf education in Arizona, as seen in student outcomes. She said the educational method leads to creative thinkers rather than taking a linear approach to the world. As with other local schools, she said ESA vouchers and enrollment are current challenges for Pine Forest. The school has been advertising and working to convince parents of the value of an in-person education that allows for interpersonal connection and teaches social skills along with academics. Pine Forest currently has 220 students from early education classes through eighth grade, and according to Rowe, it has the capacity to add more. Pre-pandemic, its enrollment was around 270, with two classrooms for each grade level. The school is currently planning some additions to its property, as construction on the new roundabout at the corner of 4th Street and Lockett Road is currently underway. Pine Forest is planning to add to the corner of its property, on that intersection, a curved wall, which will serve as both a visual and sound barrier. It will also include a new school sign on the outside, and the school students are voting on a mascot, either the dragons or the Pegasi, with which the school hopes to decorate the bell tower on top of its building. "We appreciate serving Flagstaff for sure," Rowe said. "Come visit, come see the beauty, and experience something." More about Pine Forest can be found at pineforestschool.org. And that was the article, Pine Forest School Celebrates 30 Years in Flagstaff. The next article for today is NAZ Elite This Week. Kiptoo hits PR at Boston Marathon while continuing to learn the ropes. This time around, Wesley Kiptoo knew better. The NAZ Elite athlete ran a gusty Boston Marathon on Monday, using his experience to get him to a 12th place finish and a PR of 2 hours, 8 minutes, and 54 seconds. It was just Kiptoo's third career marathon. He bounced back from a hiccup in his last outing at 26.2 miles in the 2024 edition of the New York City Marathon, where he blew up toward the end of the race. "I think it's important to see that, hey, if I really work at this for another couple of years, could I be in consideration to win one of these someday? And I think that, above all, is what we took out of this. A newfound motivation for really getting the marathon right. And he definitely took strides in doing that on Monday," Northern Arizona Elite head coach Jack Mullaney said. At New York City, Kiptoo took a precipitous fall as the final stretch of intense racing began, going from running with the leading groups to his 16th place in 2 hours, 11 minutes, and 58 seconds. "He just bled a lot of spots over that last 10K to 12K, Mullaney said, of Kiptoo's NYC performance. "This time around, I think he was smart not to go until he cracked. I think he recognized that he was getting pretty uncomfortable and needed to drop off in order to finish in a decent way." The move resulted in him besting the 2 hours, 10 minutes, and 28 seconds he set in Chicago in 2023 when making his debut at the distance. Kiptoo went out Monday with the lead group, which started off fast thanks to the favorable conditions and downhill sections of the opening half of the race. He used the pack to his advantage for most of the race, knowing there are no pacers for Boston. John Carrier won this year's Boston in 2 hours, 4 minutes, and 45 seconds, with Alphonse Felix Simbu coming in as runner-up in 2 hours, 5 minutes, and 4 seconds, and Cyprian Cottet placing third just behind the silver medalist. Connor Mance was the first American male to finish the race with a time of 2 hours, 5 minutes, and 8 seconds for fourth place. I think he did that until things got a little uncomfortable, Mullaney said, of Kiptoo running with the lead group for much of the race. And when that happened, he dropped off the lead pack around 30K, so around the 18-mile mark. After that, it was what we talked about. Once you get on an island, it's hard to stay motivated and keep your turnover. But that really has got to be the focus for this one. He did a good job of maintaining his placement in the race during that time. Sharon Lachetti won on the women's side with a time of 2 hours, 17 minutes, and 22 seconds. Jess McClain was the top American woman, running of 2 hours, 22 minutes, and 43 seconds for 7th. Mullaney said he believes this year's Boston was career's 13th career marathon. The longtime Kenyan marathoner broke the Boston course record on Monday. Meanwhile, Mullaney said he and Kiptoo learned a lot from his third marathon, especially in how the buildup unfolds. I feel like we are now more on the same page for what it takes for him, specifically, to be successful at one of these. That was good. It was good to see that step forward in the progress and see the things we implemented in this block that were newer and even higher volumes than he's done before in some of his workouts and weekly mileage, Mullaney said. So to see that payoff on race day, I think he now wants to double down on that type of stuff. And that was the article, NAZ Elite This Week. Kiptoo hits PR at Boston Marathon while continuing to learn the ropes. The next article for today is Pope Francis's funeral will feature significant security operation in Rome. From patrols on River Tiber to surveillance drones and snipers deployed at and near St. Peter's Square, Rome is preparing to throw a modern security shield around the ancient rituals of a papal funeral and its attendant huge crowds. More than 200,000 people are expected to attend Pope Francis's funeral, taking place on Saturday in Vatican Square that sits in front of Basilica of St. Peter, Rome's public transport company said. Among them will be dozens of world leaders, including heads of state, such as U.S. President Donald Trump, and royals from Belgium, Spain, and Sweden. The most complex aspect is the arrival of many dignitaries from all over the world, who will converge on Rome to go to a single point, Rome's police chief Roberto Masucci told RTL 102.5 Radio. About 2,000 local police officers will be on duty, joined by thousands more officers from the National Security Forces. Security measures will include patrol on Tiber, drones, and army device to neutralize hostile flying objects and snipers, a police source told Reuters. Streets will be closed to traffic around the Vatican on Saturday, and authorities are assessing the best route for the procession that will take the coffin from the funeral to the Basilica of Santa Maria Maggiore, where Francis chose to be buried. He died on Monday, aged 88, and tens of thousands of people have filed past his open coffin since it was laid out in St. Peter's Basilica on Wednesday. Security officers patrolled St. Peter's Square on Thursday as people waited to enter the basilica. The funeral will start at 10 a.m. Saturday. Fabio Ciciliano, head of National Civil Protection Department, said people might gather not only in St. Peter's Square, but also along the 2.5 miles separating Vatican from Santa Maria Maggiore on the other side of Tiber. Authorities will have to juggle a steady flow of VIP jets and state planes landing at Rome's airports for the event. Some delegations will want to stay in Rome for some time. Others, the vast majority we are registering at this moment, will leave immediately after the funeral, Ciciliano said, stressing the difficulty of handling so many arrivals and departures. He said the military airport of Pratica di Mare, south of Rome, will be a backup to the two city airports of Fiumicino and Ciampino in case of need. the National Railway Company will add some 260,000 seats to its trains to the capital, Civil Protection Department said. While City Airports operator ADR expects up to 20,000 more people to arrive in Rome compared to previous estimates made for the Easter holidays. And that was the article, Pope Francis's Funeral Will Feature Significant Security Operation in Rome. You're listening to the Arizona Daily Sun from the Flagstaff Studios of Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds programming is directed to those who cannot use print material due to a disability. Listen to our live streams and learn how you can support us at the website sunsounds.org. You can also get our stream and on-demand programs with the new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android devices. The next article for today is Trump asks Supreme Court to enforce transgender military ban. Donald Trump's administration asked the U.S. Supreme Court on Thursday to allow implementation of his executive order banning transgender people from serving in the military, one of a series of directives by the Republican president to curb transgender rights. U.S. Department of Justice requested that the court lift Seattle-based U.S. District Judge Benjamin Settle's nationwide order blocking the military from carrying out Trump's prohibition on transgender service members while a legal challenge to the policy proceeds. Seattle found that Trump's order likely violates the Constitution's Fifth Amendment right to equal protection under the law. The Justice Department said Settle had usurped the authority of the executive branch of government, headed by Trump, to determine who may serve in the armed forces. The judge's injunction cannot be squared with the substantial deference that the Department of Defense's professional military judgments are owed, the Justice Department said in the filing. In the case before Settle, 7 active duty transgender troops, a transgender man seeking to enlist, and a civil rights advocacy group sued over the ban. The Supreme Court directed the plaintiffs to file a response to the administration's request by May 1st. The administration's request represents an attempt to reinstate discrimination in our armed forces before the judicial process can run its course. LGBT rights group Lambda Legal, which is helping to represent the plaintiffs, said in a statement, "Transgender service members have been openly serving our country with honor and distinction for almost a decade and have met and are meeting every neutral service-based standard," it added. Trump, in January, signed an executive order that cast the gender identity of transgender people as a lie and asserted that they are unable to satisfy the standards needed for service in the American Armed Forces. A man's assertion that he is a woman and his requirement that others honor this falsehood is not consistent with the humility and selflessness required of a service member, Trump's order stated. The directive reversed a policy implemented under Trump's Democratic predecessor Joe Biden to allow transgender troops to serve openly in the American Armed Forces. The Pentagon later issued guidance to implement Trump's order, disqualifying from service current troops and applicants with a history or diagnosis of gender dysphoria or who had undergone gender transition steps. Gender dysphoria is the clinical diagnosis for significant distress that can result from an incongruence between a person's gender identity and the sex they were assigned at birth. The guidance allowed people to be considered for a waiver on a case-by-case basis if their service would directly support warfighting capabilities. The Defense Department has rationally determined that service by individuals with gender dysphoria would undermine military effectiveness and lethality consistent with similar, long-standing determinations for a wide range of other medical conditions, such as asthma and hypertension, the Justice Department's filing on Tuesday stated. The Supreme Court previously weighed in on Trump's targeting of transgender troops during his first term in office, allowing the Defense Department in 2019 to enforce a more limited restriction that had let certain personnel diagnosed with gender dysphoria after entering the military continue to serve. In blocking Trump's current ban, Settle called it an unsupported, dramatic, and facially unfair exclusionary policy, and that the administration had provided no evidence of any harm that has resulted from the presence of transgender people in the armed services. The San Francisco-based 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals declined the administration's request to put Settle's order on hold pending an appeal. And that was the article, Trump Asks Supreme Court to Enforce Transgender Military Ban. The next article for today is U.S. at Tipping Point for Return of Endemic Measles. United States is at a tipping point for the return of endemic measles a quarter century after the disease was declared eradicated, researchers say. At current U.S. childhood vaccination rate, measles could return to spreading regularly at high levels, with an estimated 851,300 cases over the next 25 years, computer models used by the researchers suggest. If rates of vaccination with measles, mumps, rubella, or MMR shot were to decline by 10%, an estimated 11.1 million cases of measles would result over 25 years, according to a report of the study in JAMA. Measles has not been endemic or continuously present in the United States since 2000. With vaccination rates dropping for MMR shots as well as for other childhood vaccines, outbreaks of preventable infectious diseases are increasing. There have been 10 reported outbreaks and at least 800 measles cases in the U.S. so far in 2025, including 624 cases and 2 deaths in one Texas outbreak, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Many state and national policies are being debated that may substantially reduce childhood vaccination even further, said study leader Nathan Lowe of Stanford Medical School. The decline in vaccination among U.S. children in recent years has been fueled by promotion of theories contrary to scientific evidence that childhood vaccines are a cause of autism and other health risks. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who now heads the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, has for decades helped sow such doubts, which accelerated during the COVID-19 pandemic with politicizing of vaccines for that virus. Drawing on state vaccination, birth and death data, and historical data on measles infections, researchers simulated a population that mirrors the U.S. population at national and state levels. Then they estimated how measles would spread under various scenarios if imported from a traveling U.S. citizen who gets infected abroad. If routine childhood vaccinations declined by 50%, the country would see 51.2 million measles cases, 9.9 million rubella cases, and 4.3 million poliomyelitis cases over the next 25 years, Lowe said. Under this scenario, Lowe said there would be 51,200 patients with lasting neurologic side effects of measles, 10,700 birth defects resulting from congenital rubella infections, 5,400 cases of paralysis from polio, 10.3 million hospitalizations, and 159,200 deaths. Small increases in vaccination rates of about 5% could keep measles from becoming endemic, the researchers' models suggest. Under current levels of vaccination, vaccine-preventable diseases, other than measles, are unlikely to become endemic, Lowe said. But if vaccination rates drop by 35%, rubella will likely become endemic, while polio, which has long been eradicated in the U.S., has a 50-50 chance of making a comeback if vaccination drops by 40%. No one can forecast exact vaccination and infection numbers, but the precise numbers don't matter, said Dr. Mujeeb Bassett, Associate Director of the Clinical Informatics Center at UT Southwestern Medical Center, who was not involved in the research. What matters, Bassett said, is the trend revealed by the study. As the vaccination rate declines, the rate of increase in measles cases speeds up. If vaccination rates go 5% lower, you'll have tens of thousands of infected patients, he said. Rates just have to be 15% less, and you're at millions of cases, he added. The trend is what people need to know. And that was the article, U.S. at Tipping Point for Return of Endemic Measles. The next article for today is Democrats Try to Deflect Intra-Party Challenges. The head of Democratic National Committee on Thursday issued a warning to a senior party official to back away from a plan to help finance progressive primary challenges to Democratic incumbents running for re-election in the 2026 midterm elections. No DNC officer should ever attempt to influence the outcome of a primary election, whether on behalf of an incumbent or a challenger, newly elected DNC chairman Ken Martin told reporters. Martin's broadside was aimed at DNC vice chairman David Hogg, who said he would raise money through an outside group, Leaders We Deserve, to foster such changes. That message came with warning that Hogg could get involved in Democratic primary campaigns, but not while holding down a DNC job. The party is weighing a possible rules change that would facilitate the firings of DNC officials for such outside activities. Hogg, 25, gained national attention after surviving a 2018 mass shooting at his high school in Parkland, Florida. He became a voice for tighter gun control and has evolved into a political activist. Since then, he has been active in progressive causes and in February won one of five DNC vice chair spots, as the party intensified its efforts to appeal to more progressive voters. The Democratic Party is engaged in a roiling battle over its future, which has progressives insisting on more aggressive responses to President Donald Trump and Republican initiatives, ranging from U.S. immigration and border security policies to tax cuts for the wealthy and the future of the Social Security retirement program. Many Democratic establishment figures want to steer the party toward expanding the Democratic base by appealing to more moderate, rural, and working-class voters that have abandoned the IT over the past several years. Martin also unveiled an Organize Everywhere, Win Anywhere strategy that he said will see $1 million a month being transferred from the DNC to Democratic organizations in all 50 states. I'm done with Democrats myopically focusing on just a few battleground states every few years, he added. Republicans won control of both chambers of Congress in addition to the White House in November, which has left Democrats with almost no ability in Washington to limit Trump's policies, and sparked a wave of intra-party recriminations. Democrats hope to regain control of at least one chamber of Congress in next year's election, with the House of Representatives seen as competitive, though they face a tough path to recapturing control of the Senate. And that was the article, Democrats tried to deflect intra-party challenges. The next article for today is Wall Street Ends Higher on Tech Boost. U.S. stocks closed higher on Thursday, rallying for a third straight day with a solid boost from technology shares as investors parsed a mixed bag of corporate earnings and watched for signs of progress in the U.S.-China tariff standoff. All three major U.S. stock indexes posted sharp gains, with the Magnificent Seven group of artificial intelligence-related megacaps boosted by AI-powered software firm ServiceNow's better-than-expected quarterly results, giving the Nasdaq the edge. Beijing called for cancellation of U.S. tariffs on China goods, following comments from U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, signaling the White House could be willing to de-escalate trade tensions that have whipsawed markets for weeks. As first quarter earnings season hits full stride, the extent to which trade war uncertainties have affected business and consumer sentiment is making itself known. Procter & Gamble, PepsiCo, Chipotle Mexican Grill, and American Airlines all cut or withdrew forecasts due to elevated uncertainty among consumers. Shares for Procter & Gamble slid by 3.7%, and PepsiCo tumbled 4.9%. Not all guidance was downbeat. ServiceNow's profit was better than analysts expected due to resilient demand for AI-powered software. Its shares jumped 15.5%. Hasbro's results beat expectations, helped by the strength of its gaming segment, sending the toymaker's shares up 14.6%. Of the 157 companies in S&P 500 that have reported so far, 74% have beaten expectations, and the analysts currently believe aggregate S&P 500 earnings growth of 8.9% year-on-year, up from 8% as of April 1st, according to LSEG. On the data front, stronger than expected new orders for durable goods and range-bound jobless claims painted a picture of economic resilience. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 486.83 points, or 1.23%, to 40,093.40. The S&P 500 gained 108.91 points, or 2.03%, to $5,484.77. And the Nasdaq Composite gained 457.99 points, or 2.74%, to $17,166.04. Alphabet shares rose in extended trading after the Google parent beat quarterly revenue estimates. On Nasdaq, 3,401 stocks rose and 1,005 fell, as advancing issues outnumbered decliners by a 3.38-to-1 ratio. S&P 500 posted four new 52-week highs and four new lows, while the Nasdaq Composite recorded 40 new highs and 51 new lows. Volume on U.S. exchanges was 14.95 billion shares, compared with the 19.15 billion average for the full session over the last 20 trading days. And that was the article, Wall Street Ends Higher on Tech Boost. The next article for today is TSA to enforce Real ID / Idaho Star Card requirement starting May 7th. Idaho Transportation Department officials are urging Idahoans to obtain a Real ID compliant Idaho Star Card before enforcement begins at airport security checkpoints May 7th. Starting May 7th, Transportation Security Administration officers will no longer accept state-issued IDs that are not Real ID compliant, Idaho Transportation Department officials said in a press release. The Idaho Division of Motor Vehicles offers the Idaho Star Card, which is compliant with the new Real ID regulations, transportation officials said. If passengers don't have an Idaho Star card, they can use another form of federally accepted identification at airport security checkpoints, including a U.S. passport, global entry card, U.S. Department of Defense ID, military ID, or any acceptable photo identification card issued by a federally recognized Native American tribe. If you arrive at an airport without a Star card or another acceptable document, you may be delayed and undergo additional examination, Idaho Transportation Department officials said in a press release. This can cause passengers to miss flights. To obtain the Idaho Star card, Idahoans must provide their Social Security card and two documents proving Idaho residency, such as current utility bills or a mortgage statement. Even though the Real ID Idaho Star card enforcement begins May 7th, time is already tight. Idahoans who need a Star card are required to visit an Idaho driver's license office in person and present a series of documents to obtain the Idaho Star card. Many Idaho driver's license offices operate by appointment only, and availability may be several weeks out. Additionally, it may take up to 2 weeks for the physical Star card to be mailed to Idahoans. Due to the tight timeline, state transportation officials are offering a couple of tips. First, they said Idahoans can visit any county driver's license office in the state to obtain an Idaho Star card. If the local office in their county is not accepting appointments in time, transportation officials encourage Idahoans to check with another county's driver's license office for faster service. Second, Idaho Division of Motor Vehicles officials are encouraging other Idahoans who don't need an Idaho Star card or who already have an Idaho Star card to free up space at physical county driver's license offices by using online Idaho DMV services. Idahoans can free up space at county DMV offices by going online to handle other tasks, like renewing their vehicle registration, changing their address, or renewing an existing driver's license. Online renewals help reduce in-office wait times at locations that allow walk-ins, making it easier and more efficient for those who need a real ID to complete their transactions, Idaho Transportation Department officials said in a press release issued Tuesday. And that was the article, TSA to Enforce Real ID Idaho Star Card Requirement Starting May 7th. The next article for today is two members from search group that uncovered Ranch of Horror are killed. Gunmen on a motorcycle shot and killed two members of a civil search organization that discovered the now infamous site known as Mexico's Ranch of Horror, the group and authorities said on Thursday. The two victims, Carmen Morales and her son, Jamie Ramirez, were shot to death by two men late Wednesday, the Jalisco State Prosecutor's Office said. Suspects had not been identified as of midday Thursday. Morales and Ramirez were members of the citizen search group Guerreros Buscadores in the western state of Jalisco, which was instrumental in the discovery of what local media dubbed the Ranch of Horror in March. Searchers found hundreds of items of clothing and skeletal remains at the site in Techilán, a rural area outside Guadalajara, the state capital. Officials have said the site was a cartel training camp. Unfortunately, Morales had already been threatened several times. "It's sad and painful that these things are happening. All we families want is to find our loved ones," said Raul Servin, a representative for the group. The Jalisco State Prosecutor's Office, however, ruled out a connection to the search group in its statement. Morales and Ramirez had been searching for a relative who disappeared in February 2024. Their deaths followed the killing of another member of the search group, Teresa Gonzalez, who had been searching for her missing brother, was killed earlier this month, according to the group. Members of search groups for missing family members often receive threats, which rights groups allege largely come from the criminal groups responsible for their disappearance. Jalisco is one of the states with the highest number of reported missing persons, according to official data. It is the home base of the powerful Jalisco New Generation Cartel, which authorities have accused of forcibly recruiting young people. More than 124,000 people are missing in Mexico, according to government data. Most cases are never solved, breeding a deep mistrust of authorities among those searching for the missing. And that was the article, Two Members from Search Group That Uncovered Ranch of Horror Are Killed. The next article is Median CEO Pay Hits Record $16.8 million on Soaring Stock Awards. Median pay among top U.S. CEOs rose 7.5% to a record $16.8 million for 2024, a new study found, as big stock grants boosted leaders' reported earnings well beyond the pay received by U.S. workers. The CEO of Axon and Union Pacific were among those getting big pay boosts from stock awards, according to the review of pay among S&P 500 CEOs by ISS Corporate, the corporate advisory arm of Institutional Shareholder Services. Other CEOs also did well, as their targets were set during the relatively stable days of 2023, said Roy Saliba, managing director at ISS Corporate, who oversaw the study. That was before U.S. President Donald Trump kicked off a trade war that has sparked turmoil in global markets in recent weeks. One thing that jumps out is that these numbers don't mesh with year-to-date stock performance or current company performance and the looming uncertainty. The time gap explains that the pay decisions for 2024 would have been made at least a year ago, Saliba said. He said his unit is advising companies to wait before changing plans to adjust pay to account for uncertainty in the markets. Boards could use a different set of performance measures that compare an executive's work against their peers, he said. Saliba's study looked at 320 companies in the S&P 500, with pay data filed so far this year. The executives did relatively well. U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics data shows average hourly earnings for U.S. workers rose 4% last year, while commerce data shows inflation ran at just below 3% in 2024. Company shares performed above those rates, helping drive the CEO's gains. Among the 320 companies Saliba reviewed, the median total shareholder return was 15.1% in 2024. At Axon, maker of the Taser stun gun, CEO Patrick Smith was at one extreme, officially receiving $164.5 million last year, up from $40,058 in 2023. In that year, he received only a salary of $31,201 and $8,857 in other compensation, including private air transportation. The stock units that accounted for most of Smith 2024 pay are an incentive for future performance in the form of a high-risk, high-reward compensation plan, and the value is realizable only if and when each set of stock price and operational goals are achieved, Axon's filing states. Axon declined to comment. At Union Pacific, CEO James Vena was paid $17.6 million for 2024 versus $2 million for his service for part of 2023, after he was hired in August of that year. The majority of his pay last year reflects big stock and option awards that a spokesperson for a railroad said are performance-based. If the company does not perform well, his actual bonus and equity will reflect that and be less, said the spokesperson. And that was the article, Median CEO Pay Hits Record $16.8 million on Soaring Stock Awards. The last article for today is PepsiCo Cuts Annual Profit Forecast. PepsiCo on Thursday cut its annual profit forecast as it signaled higher production cost and subdued consumer spending due to the uncertainty fueled by tariffs. The Frito-Lay manufacturer also posted its first quarterly profit miss in at least 5 years. Its shares were down nearly 2.5% in early trading. We expect more volatility and uncertainty, particularly related to global trade developments, which we expect will increase our supply chain costs, CEO Ramon Laguarta said in a statement. Consumer Goods, bellwether Procter & Gamble, and rival Kimberly-Clark have also lowered the profit forecasts, tempering expectations due to the tariffs uncertainty. PepsiCo forecast fiscal 2025 core earnings per share to decline 3% compared with its previous expectation of a low single-digit increase. The tariffs on trading partners have also stoked fears of high inflation and stagnation in economic growth, likely weighing on consumer spending. Relative to where we were 3 months ago, we probably are not feeling as good about the consumer, PepsiCo Chief Financial Officer Jamie Caulfield said on a post-earnings call. A P&G executive on the company's earnings call on Thursday also warned that it was unclear how long this period of consumer softness will last. Mitigation strategy. PepsiCo plans mitigation actions to address the higher supply chain costs where possible, said LaGuardia, adding it would include adjusting sourcing of key inputs. The company has 2 food plants in Mexico and 2 concentrate plants in Ireland. Price increases undertaken to offset rising costs, initially tied to the COVID-19 pandemic and supply chain disruptions, have benefited PepsiCo and peers over the past several quarters. Price hikes are doing the heavy lifting, with volume growth across its beloved brands like Pepsi, Gatorade, Lay's, and Doritos struggling to gain momentum, said Aaron Chikri, equity analyst with Hargreaves Lansdown, on the latest results. Average prices jumped 3% in the 3 months ended March 2022, while organic volumes declined 2%. More natural ingredients. PepsiCo executives said on a post-earnings call the company would accelerate the transition to natural ingredients within its portfolio. U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has pushed to remove synthetic food dyes from the nation's food supply amid concerns about a possible link between their consumption and health conditions like ADHD, obesity, and diabetes. PepsiCo, which in March said it would buy prebiotic soda brand Poppy and rival Coca-Cola, are also bolstering their healthier snacking and energy drink portfolios. And that is all the time we have for the Arizona Daily Sun. For Sun Sounds of Arizona and Flagstaff, I'm volunteer reader Julia. Thanks for listening.